This is Conspiranormal.
All right, everybody, welcome to Conspiranormal. And we are here in the 100-degree heat. Thankfully, we've got a fan and air conditioning right now. But we are sweltering.
We're just getting ready for eternity.
Yeah, I guess. I guess
at least the company will be pretty much the same.
Oh yeah,
strange realities forever. Yeah,
have a nice reunion.
It's going to be a party. That's for damn sure. We're here with someone that has been a fan of Conspiranormal for a long time and a supporter of Conspiranormal for a long time, and actually came to the Strange Realities Conference. In fact, I would say that I think he watched every single presentation at the Strange Realities Conference, and that's Vincent Treewell. And Vincent has a podcast that he does called The Weird Part. And we're going to talk about some of the weird stuff tonight and interesting stuff that he talked about on his podcast. So, Vincent, welcome to Conspiranormal.
Hey, thank you. Glad to be here. And Yes, I did go down to Nashville. And if you watch the saved feed, it's my big bald head in the back in the middle of just about every presentation.
I think at one point we had a few going and we had some kind of astronomical alignment going on with your head and Aaron Golias and a few other guys. It was
Chris Charbonneau.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We're all really shiny too.
It was like the beginning of 2001, you know? Thus spoke Zarathustra was playing at this.
Supermoon, yes.
Oh man. But yeah, so we're happy to have you on, Vincent. And I think what we're gonna start with is talk about kind of how you started doing all this and being into all the weird stuff that, you know, we talk about all the time.
Okay. Well, I can tell you it's been a lifelong journey. Started when I was really young. I was in love with In Search Of with Leonard Nimoy.
Oh yeah.
From an early age. And even as a kid, I could totally tell the difference between him and Mr. Spock. And I liked him better because he was real. And when I look back, I've watched every old episode of that show on YouTube. There's 100 and some. And I love what he did back then. And I loved it then. I love it now. I wanted to be Leonard Nimoy and just go and in search of these weird things. And what I really liked about him was he wasn't a one note person. He looked into Bigfoot. He looked into UFOs. He looked into ghosts. He looked into demonic possession. But he also looked into all these other things. He did one on the JFK assassination. He did one on at least a couple on reincarnation, on Amelia Earhart, on just everything under the sun. He did one on the Holy Grail that blew my mind even as a child. And that I always wanted to see something like that. And that's now become a thing in today's world decades later. But it really was kind of, I can't think of another show like that for that time or for a good long time after that. As I got older, then I got into Unsolved Mysteries, mm-hmm. and I got into that pretty hard. And I kind of developed a true crime interest as well, but not just true crime, this happened and this happened and the news convicted, but where there's unanswered questions, unsolved mm-hmm. crime.
Right.
Or crimes that are really weird, that have, okay, maybe we know the facts, but those facts are crazy as hell. Yeah. And, what was really going on here? And so that fed that interest. And then I got a third shift job and I had literally never heard of this guy before, but suddenly I'm being a security guard walking around all night. And this was not the kind of security where you're a rent-a-cop. This is the kind of security where you're a night watchman. You're right. Basically doing almost nothing, but you got to be awake and you got to, you know, check in and you got to be there, but you really don't have anything to do. And my life was graced with Art Bell. And I just listened to him every single night because he's on for hours. And that was just straight feeding my soul. Okay. I mean, he had guests I really loved. He had guests I despised. And I won't hesitate to mention Danion Brinkley, but we'll move on. I'll take a follow-up on that if you want. But he had good guests. He had bad guests, but he had so many fascinating guests. And he would just talk about these topics. And he covered a lot of ground as well. He would cover just everything. And, you know, that fascinated me. And I'd read so many of the familiar texts from you know, Berlitz and the Invisible Horizons and all of the paperback 1970s and 80s paranormal materials, some of which I may have been disillusioned later in life to find that they might not be the scholarly works I thought they were.
Sure. <You
know? laughs> I think we can all relate to that.
Yes, yes.
But when you're 12, it's the most amazing thing in the world.
Absolutely. And I don't regret that at all. Not a moment reading that was wasted because that was fascinating. And then I got, you know, I read Whitley Strieber in high school, and I won't say I suffered a full-on panic attack, but it was quite frightening. And Bud Hopkins and stuff like that. And kind of continued to follow these streams, but also wanted to, you know, keep abreast of the more wide variety of strange things, mm-hmm. not just a couple focused points. And then, let me see. I came across, quite by accident, at a bookstore. Barnes & Noble still sells this over the counter, as far as I know. A British magazine called 14 Times.
Yeah.
And that blew my mind. And I learned about Charles Fort and his whole thing. And they run a hell of a good operation over there. I'm a subscriber just so I can get it on time regularly. But it's well worth reading every month. And they have the perspective that I try to have and that I really like. They're not believers, mm-hmm. but they're not debunkers. They're what you'd call a true skeptic, you know, and they'll call something out and explain, no, this is just total BS. This is why. But they'll have a why. Right. They explain stuff. They don't explain it away, you know. And I really, and they're willing to be open and hold things in a gray area that could be not. And I like that. And I think that's a sign of an open mind and intellectual strength. If you have to have a cut and dried answer for everything, that's really not the best. You know, that's not productive and it's not good for you. You know, I try to get away from that, you know. Then in, I believe it was 05, a movie called The Mothman Prophecies came out. And it's a good movie. It stars Richard Gere. It's, you know, I give it two thumbs up. But it has maybe at most 10% of what's in the book. And having seen the book, having seen the movie, I need to get the book. Plus, I was going to buy anything called The Mothman Prophecies. I mean, come on. You know? You're reeling me in there. And so I got that, and that really blew my mind. And Keel changed my whole way of thinking and looking at this stuff. And he was really, you know, open to all the different levels of and types of weirdness, and that maybe they're somehow connected. And that percolated in my mind. And then when I started listening a couple of years later, started listening to podcasts, I started in the most mainstream podcast possible, which would be This American Life on NPR.
Yeah.
That's pretty mainstream. Yeah.
It's about as mainstream as it gets. Yes. But they hooked me in with a story called The Ghost of Bobby Dunbar. And it was fascinating. No actual ghosts involved, but it was about this kid who goes missing and then he's found, and a rich family says, oh, that's our missing son. And a poor family says, oh, that's our missing son. And spoiler alert, he goes to the rich family. But DNA may contest that or it may not. They made a movie with Angelina Jolie about it. And it's an absolutely fascinating story that has so much more than I'm telling right now, that there may have been more than one kid abducted. There's a whole winding story to that. And that got me listening to their podcast. And then they had the podcast Serial, which was unsolved true crime, or at least tried to be. And that got me more into podcasts. And I'm like, man, I'd really like to do something like that. I really like that. But NPR, I mean, they have like 30 people working on that. They have writers, directors, sound engineers. The person speaking isn't even the person who wrote the script. You know, right. They have researchers and fact checkers. And I'm like, well, how do you get into this? What am I supposed to burn some CDs and mail them to NPR? I mean, you know? So I'm looking around and I'm Googling paranormal podcasts. And I came upon Soraya Ascath and Where'd the Road Go? And right about that same time, I came upon you guys, and I came upon Timothy Renner, Strange Familiars. And I realized, you know, people are just doing this. They're not getting like a whole staff and a whole corporation. They're just like creating this thing and making it happen. And I said, I'm not going to do it today, but I'm going to do it. And, you know, eventually it was far more complicated than I expected. And I got a real serving of not knowing what I was getting into, but it has borne a little bit of fruit and starting to work out. And I mean, in no small part, I couldn't have done it without you guys, you know?
Well, thank you.
Appreciate it.
Thank you, Vincent. We're glad to have you join the club too. And, you've also been doing the liner notes, I guess, for Where Did the Road Go, too. So we should point that out as well. If you listen to that podcast, Vincent does all that.
Which is, that's a real honor. And I listen to it once for fun, and I sit down and really listen to it and like try to have all the references in there in case people want to look stuff up. And I really get a kick out of that. I love it. Awesome. It's kind of my story and where I showed up. Well, then I guess we get to the pandemic hits, and I see the 2020 Strange Realities Only online, and I attend that online, and that, you know, reeled me in further and made connections with a lot of other people. And so that's why I had to be in Nashville last year and have to come back this year.
You got on the bus to come to Nashville too.
That's awesome.
I learned some. I do not regret that for one second. Totally do it again in a heartbeat. There were different reasons for that, including I didn't have the driver's license to let you get on a plane yet. So I've got that now. I don't plan on revisiting our fare bus system anytime soon. It's funny because I usually travel by train, and that's,
oh, yeah.
That's wonderful. I love Amtrak, but they don't Amtrak from Milwaukee to Nashville.
No, the closest you're going to get is Memphis. Yeah.
Yeah. And so there was no way around just taking the bus, which I learned that where the bus station and the train station are the same building, like in Milwaukee, they're pretty nice. It's actually wonderful. Where it's just the bus station, it's like going to jail. Okay.
Yeah.
It's very bad.
I've been in a few myself. It's really bad.
It's really bad. And so, yeah. Do I regret it? Hell no. Had a great time. Yeah, awesome time. I'm flying in this year.
Okay. Yeah. You're flying in this year. All right. Cool.
Oh, yeah.
So, we'd be glad to have you come and hang out with us again. For sure.
I wanted to ask you, you know, out of all these mysteries, is there anything that they have in common that really draws you to certain ones, and what makes them interesting to you?
I like the one-offs a lot. I like the cryptids that don't fit a like kind of standard procedure.
Mm-hmm.
The just absolutely weird ones, especially when they come from someone who has no interest in telling the story. In fact, would rather not tell the story because I don't want everybody to think I'm crazy. But that's sometimes I think the most credible ones, you know, are things that people see, and there's often like they don't get anything out of it,
right?
You know, and it's but they saw something. I absolutely believe they saw something, and though that really draws me in. That and where there's just these lingering, hanging questions that may never be answered, but I can't seem to let go of them. You guys have really spread out a lot and are covering a lot of stuff. I love the one you did on Shakespeare.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. That was a fun one. Yeah.
Yeah. And it was like, you know, that's kind of out of the norm for the paranormal, if you want to call it that. But it was really fascinating. And it's kind of that in search of ethos that yeah. we're going to look at everything. If I had to pick one that really sticks with me, the giant bones, the bones of giants
mm-hmm. okay.
that have been found in so many places. And I know I did an episode on this on my little podcast there.
Yep.
And this stuff is documented in the newspapers, and this really happened. And, you know, they weren't impossible giant. They weren't 40 foot tall. You know, they weren't something that couldn't exist physically. But they're sometimes 8 feet tall. Okay. Which is a very, very large man. They're sometimes, you know, between 7 and 9 feet tall. And that happened. And there was a disgraceful casualness with which these, you know, get these bones out of here so we can build the bank or whatever. But that happened. And it happened a lot in Wisconsin, but it happened really all over America. And I'm sure they haven't all been dug up. And I'd really like to know who are those people? You know, they could be, well, they could be many things. And that draws me in and does not let go.
Yeah, it's definitely been a source of endless speculation for a couple hundred years. Do you have any pet theory that you have about them?
I do. this is a pet theory.
Yeah.
I tend to be a hyper diffusionist. A person who believes that there was a lot more contact among the continents before Columbus mm-hmm. than what is in the historical record or the archaeological record. And you got to be careful with this because there's so many people trying to infiltrate that field who have a political agenda for today and that really want to find that, well, 10,000 years ago, white people were here. Well, 10,000 years ago, it's questionable whether anybody was white, but that's a side story. But, you know, I think that they may have been Neanderthals, that there may have been a, you know, I wouldn't even say lost race because they weren't lost. They're lost to us because we don't know much of anything that happened before writing in the Middle East a few thousand years ago. Doing archaeology, I had the opportunity when I was quite young to go to an archaeological dig site and participate in it at one of the local colleges. And what you're finding it's like doing crime scene forensics on something that happened centuries ago.
Yeah.
I mean, you're not getting an accurate picture, but that's the science that's accepted. At a lower level of acceptance, you have the folklore of the people who were living there, but people moved around a lot over thousands of years. And the people living there when the English arrived or the French may not have been the people living there 1,000 years earlier.
Yeah, they often told him that they were not the same people.
Yes, in fact, yes. I mean, that's, yeah. And it's a, you know, a pretty open secret. And so you have folklore. And then way back before that, it's just so much, often it's a blank. It's a lot of guesswork. It's a lot of gray area. And I think that there could have been an existing population of Neanderthals a lot later than anybody thinks. And that, you know, that might be an explanation. The weird stories of, in the folklore, of white-haired giants, of different, of the giants, and of them being a different type of person, to me, kind of describes Neanderthals, though we don't know, and we don't even, you know, it's all very, very unformed at this point, if it's ever going to be resolved. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of stuff is probably, at least for the foreseeable future, lost to the ages. There's a lot of prehistory. And that's, but as far as, if I had to guess, I would say Neanderthals lived a lot longer in North America than anybody thinks they did. And just let me add one little thing, because I found it to be important. Something as simple as where did the horse come from is hugely contested and debated in legitimate academia. The conventional narrative is that while the horse evolved partially in North America, the Native Americans didn't have horses until they stole them from the Spanish.
Right.
But there's been a number of Native American academics who have rebutted that and who have, you know, produced scholarly works that show, no, we always had horses. We had horses. We've always had horses. Okay. We had horses way before the Europeans arrived. Our society depended on horses. And so much of that is, which is not, you know, it's not a million years ago. It's a few hundred years ago. But a lot of that is lost to history. It's very much an open question. Mm-hmm. And that was something that blew me away when I was looking up some of this stuff for one of the podcasts.
Yeah, well, I've always heard about that with the horses, is that horses were in North America, but when the megafauna died out, they died out then. But it could be possible that they could have survived, and it's just a one long continuing. I guess there would be a way to do DNA studies on horses that we might be able to find out conclusively. I mean, probably most horses are European in origin, or Eurasian, rather.
The ones that are here now, yes.
Yeah, but there might be some other more, you know, Native American horses that are mixed in, possibly. That's interesting. I never thought about that before.
Until I read this professor's piece on it while I was looking up, I think it was while I was looking up something. It escapes me. But anyway, something unrelated. And this popped up. And like, here's her PhD thesis on why horses were pre-Columbian in the Americas. And I was like, pow, okay. And it's supported by this and this and this. Okay. That's a new one. And this stuff is always kind of opening and linking to other things, mm-hmm. which is, I love that. You know, you get really into studying one thing and you end up, it branches out and branches out and branches out, which is,
yeah,
it's great. It's just a matter of having the time and organization to do the kind of research that you want to do, you know?
Tell me about it, man. Yeah, I think a lot of, you know, a lot of this stuff is really about archaeology being such a young discipline, and they have really had to overcorrect so much for kind of the amateur armchair sport of the leisure class that it was when it was, you know, antiquarianism. And so I feel like there's room for both research and fascination with these mysteries that even verges on, you know, spirit quest for the lost civilization and things like that. But, you know, at some level, it's like you just can't expect the archaeological establishment to follow you on your own spirit quest, though. It's kind of like a separate thing, you know?
Yes, I fully agree there, yeah.
But a lot of archaeologists are just so unsympathetic to people who are really like looking for these big questions and the biggest questions, you know, our origin and where civilization comes from and all and spiritual things. You know, I think a lot of the archaeological establishment is kind of like poo-pooing to those things, which I think are very important also.
Oh, absolutely. Well, there's a real hard bias in academia.
Yeah.
And it's against big discoveries. It's for small incremental discoveries,
right,
that don't really matter that much. There is nothing like Graham Hancock. There's nothing he could say that the establishment would find acceptable.
Right.
It doesn't matter what he found, how he backed it up. It doesn't. That's not going to get the next grant.
Right.
That's not going to get the department chair.
But it moves hearts.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
And imaginations.
His work is priceless, yes. There's something also that I think is true that Soraya comments on a lot, that when archaeology was young, it was fighting against religion was very powerful. Mainstream Christian religion was very powerful. And they didn't want to find anything that would confirm the Bible. Mm. Even if it didn't really confirm the Bible, but they didn't want to find floods. Didn't want to find giants. They didn't want to find anything that sounds like you might be confirming the Bible. And so the opposite view was taken, and a lot of that stuff was edited out. And that doesn't, like, neither undercut nor endorse the Bible, but it's just these bones are still here, you know? And this stuff looks like it was caused by a flood. And you can have a flood and not, you know, become an Episcopalian. It doesn't, you know, it's not one of those.
Well,
it's, you know,
I think, you know, I listened to your Tower of Babel episode and just the idea that, you know, I think the flood was many different catastrophes. It was a memory that was had of many different catastrophes, and one of which probably would have been what destroyed whatever was around the time of the Younger Dryas. So I think that there is a, I guess, would you call it an archetypal memory or a genetic memory,
yeah,
of
this? Oh, yes. Type I think of, it's a real thing.
Of a major, major catastrophe, which we're finding out more and more because of Randall Carlson and some other people. We're finding out more and more that more than likely there was some kind of cataclysm in the very ancient past. But I think it's also a memory of other things that happened. The Black Sea, the Minoan civilization. It all just kind of, once it was put into the Bible, it was all jumbled up together into the flood story.
It's the way that myth works.
Yeah.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
The flood was based off of the Epic of Gilgamesh originally, or what was described in the Epic of Gilgamesh. So,
and we don't have much of anything before that.
You know? Right.
No, we don't.
Yes, but that makes a lot of sense.
But each culture has a flood story. Mm-hmm. They have a creation myth and they have a flood myth. It's pretty universal. Yeah.
And we see things change, at least for the people right there, drastically all the time. So the idea that would be a driving force and, you know, that something could wipe out whole civilizations does not seem far-fetched to me in the least, you know?
And I wonder if the Nephilim, I was thinking about this when I was listening to that episode, I wonder if the Nephilim mythology, first of all, it's kind of a mistranslation or a transliteration, but I do wonder if some of this giant stuff with the Nephilim is because these ancient cultures might have dug into some of these mounds or dug into some of these themselves and found these giant skeletons, and they had to find a way to explain this. So I wonder if some of that is possible. Because we know that the ancient Greeks found dinosaur bones.
And hence dragons. Yes. Yeah,
right.
And that makes, yes, I think there's also some reverse, you know, we found this thing, now let's explain it. Oh, I think that's absolutely something that happens and has happened throughout history. The Nephilim fascinate me. I'm not a religious guy. I'm not, you know, trashing anybody else's religion, but I'm pretty agnostic. But I am fascinated by the whole idea and how well that fits in with a lot of the pagan pantheons that these kind of superhero-like people that, you know, come from another place, but it's not that far away. I mean, it's like at the top of the mountain or something.
Right. Demigods.
And yes, demigods. And you've got Thor and Dionysus and Perseus and all of these people. And if they're your enemy, then you've got Goliath, you know, and they're mighty men, but they're not impossible. You know what I mean? They're not, you know, 50 feet tall. They're, you know, 9 feet tall and have 7 fingers on each hand and are really super strong, but just like in a impressive to us level, not in an impossible level. And that seems more like something that could really happen than it does like just, you know, the tenets of a religion.
Yeah.
That seems like it would be based on actual events.
Well, and it happens naturally. I mean, there are, you know, very tall people.
If Shaq ever gets time travel, let me tell you, he's going to show up around.
He's going to be the god king of Samaria.
And tall is relative, too. I mean, it said that Charlemagne was tall, but we think he was about 6 feet. But that was odd in 800 AD, as opposed to, you know, when everybody's probably like, you know, 5 feet, you know, that's going to be a giant to you. But there are some people that think Charlemagne wasn't real, but, you know, if you're going to buy new chronology, yeah, then Charlemagne isn't real. But anyway, that's just a personal soapbox.
No, I get you. And the flip side, people think Napoleon was short and he was of average height. He was just a regular person. You know, he gained a following, but they always portray him as this little guy who like has a chip on his shoulder because he's under a certain height. And no, he was right about average for his time. You know?
Yeah,
it's one of those things.
Some of that could have been British propaganda. I mean, you know.
Which is always a factor.
Short little man.
Short little Frenchman.
Stuff like that.
Yeah. That's always a factor. Somebody's writing, especially during times of war and, you know, political conflict. I wonder how short or tall Kim Jong-un really is compared to, well, that's unfair because he's the one non-starving person, so it's tough to say. Yes. Other people in his society, yes.
So, Vincent, the people want to know, though, where are the bones?
There, that gets interesting, doesn't it? I wish I had a quick and easy answer. So just go down to the library the museum over at the corner of such and such. No. Unfortunately, in Wisconsin, they reside in two locations, still buried in the sacred mounds that were preserved, which is where they belong. And unfortunately, just thrown away and scattered in the name of progress because, and this was in one of the newspaper articles that I posted there, that they were digging to make a new sidewalk and they found these gigantic bones, but they didn't really... It wasn't like that big a deal. It's kind of like, we'll get these bones out of the way so we can get the sidewalk built. And so a lot was just trashed. I think there are some that are still undiscovered. I think that if you go to that lake over by Estelan State Park and we're able to do some scuba diving archaeology at the bottom, you might find some fascinating things. And it's not called Estelan State Park for no reason. Mm-hmm. It looks a hell of a lot like Aztlan in Mexico. Yes. Well, there's a pyramid, you know. So some of the bones I believe we have in the ground under the sacred mounds, which is good. And obviously the people to whom those mounds are sacred aren't wild about anybody digging them up, especially after everything that's happened. I think some were disappeared by the Smithsonian. I'm not saying there's a vast ongoing conspiracy, but I'm saying in some occasions, I think there was an effort to keep these. We want to keep them, but we want to keep them out of sight so that people who aren't quite as intelligent and sophisticated as us don't get the wrong impression.
Mm-hmm.
And I think some are held at institutions like that. Yes.
Do you think it would be kind of the same argument about something like UFOs or alien existence now, that it would just cause too much social chaos, or it questions too many cultural and religious assumptions, that it's just safer to not have it be public?
And that would, oh, absolutely. And that was even a more pronounced attitude 100 right. years ago, when, I mean, it's literally guys sitting around in the country club, you know, in the smoking jackets and everything, mm-hmm. deciding what can be released and what can't. I'm glad you touched on that, because I really am of two minds on this when it comes to UFO disclosure. And part of me says, yeah, we've had our legs pulled so many times before. It's all BS. It's just a psyop. The government doesn't know any more than we do. I understand that. And that's a valid point of view. But part of me kind of thinks they do, okay? And that they're holding on and slowly warming us up for it. And I know the warming has been really slow, but every time we get something, a hint that, well, you know, there might have been life on Mars a long time ago, but there isn't now. We know for sure there isn't now. Well, we don't know that, you know. But I'll tell you, before the pandemic, I was ready to pound on the table and say, I want disclosure. I want you SOBs and the government to tell us everything you know. We're the American people. We have a right to know. Bring out the aliens. I want the alien bodies. I want the crashed ships.
And the giants while you're at it.
Yeah. Yes. I demand the truth. And then the pandemic happened and I realized, geez, half people are going to attack the aliens if they see them and think they're demons. Mm-hmm. So it's...
You don't want that to happen anymore.
No way. You know, I follow some people that I don't agree with, but I just like to know what they're thinking.
Yeah, continue.
Yes, and there are a number of people on social media who are diehard paranormal believers, but everything's Satan.
Yeah,
Bigfoot is Satan. Mm-hmm. Ghosts, Satan. UFOs, Satan. Literally anything that isn't,
yeah,
you know, in the zoo, the dog man, Satan. Mm-hmm. You know,
everything is demons.
Yes, yes, indeed. I swear, if they see a three-legged dog, it's the devil. You know, maybe it's just a dog. You know, but yes, there's very much that attitude, and unfortunately, that attitude predates the internet.
Mm-hmm.
When I was younger, I was involved with some fundamentalist religious people. And that's probably why I'm an agnostic now. They were quite a cast of characters. And I had a guy seriously tell me, a volunteer chaplain, as a matter of fact, tell me that, you know, they're putting movies out like E.T. to normalize the demons that come down and pretend to be aliens.
Oh yeah, I've heard that.
Yeah. Childhood's End.
Yes, yes. And they want us to think they're aliens, but they're really demons. And they want us to come. They want to come down here and have us accept them, and then they'll take over.
So instead of a heart light, he's going to eat your heart.
Yes, yes.
That's That's what's going to happen. That reminds me a little bit of like the Satanic Toys thing that they tried to get going.
Oh, yeah.
In the 80s where they...
Oh, yeah. I knew people who would not let their kids play with Ninja Turtles because Ninja Turtles are of the devil. And it's like they're turtles who fight a crime with karate weapons.
Maybe it's because they're named after Renaissance humanist painters. I don't
know. Oh, well, you got really deep there, Adam.
Or it could be that you're just crazy.
We're actually ascended hermetic masters.
Yes, Leonardo, Michelangelo, Donatello.
But yes, there are people who totally bought into that. And I put that in the past tense. There are people today who, feel that way.
Yeah.
See it maybe everywhere.
It makes me think, though, I mean, if the phenomena really is as weird as people like us think it is, then, you know, maybe it actually is kind of like that, in that they know something, but they really couldn't even explain enough of it to not actually disrupt society. I mean, because it's probably weirder than space aliens. And how are you even going to release that type of information? How can you even be the authority to disclose something like that?
I think that there's a lot of truth to that. There's something Terrence McKenna said that has stuck with me. And I'm paraphrasing, but only a little bit.
Do you do a good impression?
I'm not even going to try. Okay,
That's just Joshua Cutchin's wheelhouse. We'll let him do that. Josh will probably be on in a few episodes anyway, so we'll
and he does let, him do his, impression. Yes.
Let him do his Terrence McKenna impression.
He gets it down. But what he said was that I believe we're dealing with something that is portraying itself as an extraterrestrial invasion in order not to disturb us.
Yeah.
And that was, dude. Oh, man. What if they're coming as aliens because we defined aliens less scary than what they really are? And wow. You really fully get that one. It's like, They may be handling us with, kid gloves to not freak us out. And that's, I think that's worth considering. And the whole disclosure thing, I just always keep in mind they can only do it once.
Right.
The press conference with the alien where they walk out and here he is, or here it is. That can only happen once. You don't get a reboot with that. You don't get a do-over.
Yeah.
And the world reacts how it reacts. And I don't predict it reacts all that great, And we don't know what their values might be. They might be radically different from ours. And there's always the built-in, when it comes to aliens, when it comes to extraterrestrials, there's always the built-in that this is something new. Much harder to accept would be, oh no, we've been here for a million years. We watched you guys evolve. Yeah, we watched. We assisted you guys in evolving, that would be much harder to accept. If they're brand new from Alpha Centauri, that's one level of a lot to deal with. But the idea that they've always been here and that we have interacted forever, that's a lot. And that would disrupt literally anybody, including ourselves, mental picture, worldview,
However, I think just something that's far more likely, I think, in my opinion.
Oh, absolutely.
We're much more dealing with something that is of this world, just on a different plane than we are.
Yes, and something ancient, something that predates us.
I want to continue a little bit about this guy, Joseph Mahan, that you met, some of this lost history stuff that you were talking about.
Oh, yes. That was, and that's one where I don't hold back on calling that a synchronicity. The idea that I would happen to be at the Civil War Navy Museum, which he was the curator of, in the last year or so of his life. And apparently, he was very, active and, walking and talking and, you know, giving his spiel. He was kind of a boring professor. Mm-hmm. He liked to talk and I was there to listen. And he blew my mind. And that was a life-changing event. At that time, I was in the military. I was at Fort Benning. And right, you know, across the street is the city of Columbus, Georgia. And mm-hmm. my friend, we had nothing else to do that weekend. So we went to this museum, and it was basically empty. And then the curator asks us, can we help him carry in these artifacts that he has from his car? Well, sure, yeah. And we start carrying in these weird-looking stones, and they're carved with things that look kind of like hieroglyphics. And I especially remember one that has the body of a man and the head of a goat. And I'm looking at this, and I'm like, wow, what is this stuff?
That's like a reverse pan.
Yes, yes, as a matter of fact, yes. And I mean, some would compare it to Baphomet or, you know, mm-hmm. there's a lot of things you could make out of it. And I'm like, what are these things? And he said, they come from a cave in Illinois. And I'm like, Illinois? Because I'm thinking they came from Egypt or something. And he says, yes, they were part of a worldwide system of shrines that existed, you know, centuries and centuries ago. And he gives me about an hour of his view of hyperdiffusionism. The old world and the new world never really were old and new. They interacted way more than there's a historical record of. And there's lots of reasons for that, including, you know, especially that if you're Columbus, you want to discover something. You don't want to just show up at somebody else's place and like have to pay taxes and, you know, then leave. To justify conquest, you had to act like these people have never seen civilization before, instead of they've been interacting with us for centuries, and really there wasn't nearly as big a separation as people think. And there's, when you get the cave that he found that stuff in, which I don't have on the tip of my tongue, it's in the podcast, but it's controversial. The guy who owned it was not what I would call, you know, a person of great character. They're mostly interested in what can I get for these artifacts. Mm-hmm. That, unfortunately, that's common enough not to be exclusive to fakery. You know, that doesn't mean they're fake. They may be real. He just wanted to milk it for as much as he could, as people in the art industry and the, you know, the antiquities trade do all the time. You know, but there was a cave where they found stuff that came from the Middle East, that came from Asia, that came from Europe. And Mahan had written multiple books on this subject and believed that there was a lost worldwide system of shrines where, you know, people were in a spiritual system where you had to go and visit these shrines to gain like another initiation. Mm-hmm. And I asked him, well, what religion was this? And that's when he presented to me his 32nd degree Mason's ring.
Oh, of course.
And blew my mind again. Yes. And he said, yeah. This, and I said, Masonry? And because my granddad was a Mason. And it seemed interesting, but it didn't seem like, you know, this Raiders of the Lost Ark level of what? And he says, Masonry is the remnants of that ancient religion that involved sun kings. And the sun kings were all around the world, from Japan, through Africa, through Europe, through Asia, through what we call North and South America. The religion was based on sun kings, and the remnants of that, the, you know, whatever the leftovers that are still able to be put together are esoteric Freemasonry. And wow, that was a game changer for my way of thinking. Yes. So yeah, that happened, and I got a lot out of that. And unfortunately, Dr. Mahan died the next year, and his Institute for the Study of American Cultures only went on for a limited number of years thereafter. But there's some fascinating materials there.
So nobody has carried this on, you don't think, or?
Nobody has carried it on as well as it should have been. When you get into studying where he left off, and it's really like panning for gold because there's so many fakers and there's so many people with a political agenda and there's so many just straight out weirdos in there. And I don't mean that in a good sense for once. There are just some bad people involved with that these days. There are people who want to have a white supremacist angle to grind, which is ridiculous. That's the opposite of what Mahan was saying at all. In fact, he believed that there were Africans in America way before Columbus, and that trade had been worldwide, including China and Japan, way before Columbus. But there's people who have their own thing to find, and there's people who want to make money off it. And without picking on this particular group, there are some Mormons who would like to just find stuff that backs up the Book of Mormon.
Oh, yeah.
And that's like a big partisan struggle in anything you get in alternative history.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just one of those things.
Vincent, do you know what part of Illinois these were in? Because I'm wondering, I'm wondering if it's Southern Illinois, because, you know, I talked not long ago with Jason Andrews, Paranormal Patio podcast, and we talked about some of this. He lives in that part of Illinois, which incidentally is called Little Egypt, by the way, because you've got
Cairo there. Oh, I know exactly what he's talking about. Yes, yeah. And it does look a lot like Egypt. Yeah.
So I wonder if this came from Southern Illinois. I wonder if there's any way we could know what part of Illinois it came from. Well, let's talk a little bit about some of this other stuff that you've talked about on the show. One of the things you talked about, Rebecca Brown and the Satanic Conspiracy. This is some good old fashioned satanic panic stuff.
Oh yes, she was a godmother of the Satanic Panic, and I heard her stuff taught from the pulpit like it was the news. Like this was, you know, source verified, you know, material. This really happened. Like there was no doubt at all. And she was just completely full of it. I mean, it was just a lot of lies. She, under a different name, was a doctor. She had been a registered nurse and then she became a doctor. And then I don't know her life circumstances, but she went way off the rails. And she began living with a patient and became fanatically religious. And at the same time was prescribing her patients, including her roommate and her roommate's handicapped daughter, huge amounts of pain medicine. And this all eventually led to her being exposed publicly and losing her medical license. And she was lucky not to go to jail. This was in a pre-opioid epidemic world. Today, I think she probably would be incarcerated. And she just left medicine behind and probably made a lot more money selling these lurid stories of demons behind every tree that were just ate up by people who really, really should have known better. And it was kind of, there's something I experienced being in fundamentalist churches that there's a sort of what I might call holy lies, that if a story fits what you want to believe, there's very little critical thinking. There's very little fact checking that goes on. People just swallow it whole. And that has had, well, some pretty huge political consequences. Either that or Biden really wants to kill all your children and like turn over to the Chinese, you know. one of those things is true.
One of those. It's either A or B.
Yes, yes. And just the biggest nonsense can be pitched out there. And as long as it's coming from a person who shares your views and, you know, fits the narrative that you're already comfortable with, then it doesn't get questioned. And that's a huge mistake.
Don't we know it?
Yes.
I see it every day now. It's absurd.
Especially down here.
Oh, yeah.
And she took that to a level that I don't think too many people had taken it to prior to that. She was never as well known as, say, Oral Roberts, you know, or Pat Robertson. But she had a bizarro ministry that basically everything, and when I say this, it sounds like an exaggeration, but it's not. Literally anything you touch can be demonic. And you can have demons sticking to you. And she literally said, if you go to a thrift shop and get a piece of clothing, it could put you in contact with demons.
Right. Because you don't know who was wearing it before and what they did. If they were conjuring Beelzebub. And,
it's like a contagion.
Yes. Yes. And anything that has, I mean, I remember somebody had something that had a image of a geisha girl on it. And I don't mean like a pornographic one, just like a picture, you know, of the traditional garbed Japanese lady. And that was an opening for a demon. And like anything. Wow. And her and Jack Chick work hand in glove.
Mm.
And Jack Chick, I'm assuming, doesn't need much introduction.
For anybody that's not familiar with Jack Chick, Jack Chick was this really arch fundamentalist cartoonist, and he wrote these little things called Chick Tracks, and there's these little comic books that are kind of like rectangular little comic books, and their whole purpose is to be left at, like, you know, public restrooms or just anywhere for people for kids to read. And he was also virulently anti-Catholic.
Oh yeah,
anti Freemason, anti, you know, all the stuff, all of the above, but very anti Catholic. And actually, my favorite title of a Jack Chick tract was "The Death Cookie,"
which I almost knew you were going to say that. Yeah,
which was about the communion wafer. That's like that's the best. Like, that should be a band name, just Death Cookie. Well, no, if someone's listening, you want to form a metal band or some shit, just Death Cookie.
My favorite was Trick, which is one they don't publicly distribute anymore, but you can still get them from their website if you want them.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I mean, the website, you can find all of them. You can at least you used to be able to. You can read every single Chick tract, and they are hilarious. Well, they would be hilarious if they just weren't so damn serious. You know, like he was 100% serious.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Well, and what I liked about Trick was it starts out with this ridiculous lie. It was a total, absolute lie that every year emergency rooms all around the country are packed full of children who are suffering from poisoned Halloween candy.
Oh, right, right.
Yeah. It's like, no, that doesn't happen. That literally does not happen.
Okay. That's another thing from the Satanic Panic era was the poison Halloween candy. Yeah.
Yes. And emergency rooms are full. And it's like, wait, if that happened even once, do you think we'd do it next year? Come on.
You know?
The FBI did a study of, and I don't have a citation, but it's easily Googleable. The FBI did a study a number of years ago about poisoned Halloween candy. And they found that in a 20-year period, 20 children had died of poisoned Halloween candy. So it's one per year on average. Of those 20, 18 had been poisoned by their parents. So it's like something that's just
right,
almost doesn't exist.
Right.
You know,
right.
And it, right. He was just doing his thing. But again, people bought that and believed it. Yeah. And it was a holy lie. It was something that fit the narrative you already believe. So instead of looking up, gee, I didn't hear any kids around here dying of Halloween candy. Like nobody questioned it. Nobody fact checked it. And people, oh, you can't go out there. You'll die of Halloween candy. And even though that really almost never, ever happens, it continues to exist in urban legend, you know? And yeah, Rebecca Brown worked hand in glove with Jack Chick on her first two books, which are He Came to Set the Captives Free and Prepare for War. And
that's a subtle title.
Yes, yes. Right. And she had just these wild, off-the-wall stories. At some point, she's confronted by a werewolf. She, like, astral-traveling people break into her house and, like, are beating her up and destroying her stuff. Just crazy things. Her, Elaine, her patient, who she also is helping get away from demons, says that she was at one point she was literally a bride of Satan. And right. Of course she met with people at the Vatican and, you know, with all the government bigwigs, and they're all in on this together. And kind of the point of the podcast I did there was that the whole QAnon universe, the idea that the entire world could be run by Satanists, and not even like we kind of, those of us who are listening to this and talking about this kind of understand what Satanism actually means, but this is the like comic book version of Satanists, and that they literally run the whole world and eat children. And she came up with that way before it caught on, but she kind of laid the foundation for all that. And after the first two books, Jack Chick refused to work with her anymore.
Wow. She was too extreme for Jack Chick.
Yes. You've burned some bridges when you're that far out there. But her books are available now. Her ministry continues. She's under the name Yoder. I'm sorry. I have to take that back. Her husband continues the ministry. She did die a year or two ago of natural causes at an older age. Did a lot of damage, yeah.
She reminds me a little bit of Sherry Schreiner.
Oh, yeah.
I'm familiar with Sherry Schreiner. Yeah.
I would say the big difference is I think Sherry Schreiner believed the crap that she was saying. I don't really think Rebecca Brown believed a lot of that stuff. I think she found a really good marketing system and was really making a lot of money. Her books have sold millions and her ministry was going. And it's the kind of ministry we're expected to donate a lot of money. So it was, yeah, I'm not saying she didn't believe any of it, but she believed it in a way that was very prosperous for her. You know, Sherry Schreiner, I think, was just crazy. A different story. Go ahead.
Definitely. I think she found her niche. But you're right. I mean, all this stuff with QAnon and all this right now, it's recycled again and again and again.
Yes, yes. Well, I remember hearing that Xerox machines are all based on 666. So I don't know. If you copy something, what, it belongs to the devil? I don't even know what that means. Or they already have the UPC code things for when we all have to get the number of the beast, and they can just scan it on your hand. And I heard all that stuff back in the early 90s.
Yeah, that was all. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
None of this is new, you know.
Barcode technology was the number of the beast and all that.
Yes. Right. Yes.
I remember people were saying that Ronald Reagan was the Antichrist because each of his names had six letters. Ronald Wilson Reagan. People were serious about this stuff.
And yeah, oh, yeah, oh yes. That's, and
I don't know if you remember 88 Reasons Why the World Will End in 1988.
That sounds vaguely familiar.
Yeah.
I do remember reading 1994 question mark, a hugely popular book at the time by Harold Camping.
Yeah.
And he,
Camping's got a good reputation. He's been right so many times.
Holding it absolute zero, but yes. And yeah, it's funny to me, funny, not, you know, it is what it is, but it's odd to me that he did put, in case I'm wrong, it's going to be 2012. In case it's not 1994 that Christ returns, which, spoiler alert, if he did, they covered it up.
Well, some people think we're in an alternate reality because they turned on CERN at some time around 2012. So that's
That's probably what happened.
Let's talk about your thoughts on the whole Mothman thing. You had a different kind of interesting take on this.
I do. And hey, I never thought I'd get a chance to talk about this publicly. That's very nice. I mean, other than the podcast that I put out. Yes. I think, now, I am not denying anyone else's experience. If you had an experience, I would never tell you you didn't. Okay. But I do look at, I try to keep, be open-minded and look at other possibilities. There's an image of Mothman, and that's of a humanoid, broad-shouldered, like stocky humanoid with no head and two big red eyes and then these big wings behind it. And he takes off and he flies, but he doesn't fly by flapping these huge wings, which begs the question, well, why do you have wings if you don't need them to fly? You know, you can just sort of levitate straight up. What are these wings for? It doesn't seem like a biological creature in the least. Okay. It doesn't to me. What it does seem like is if you're a person minding their own business in the woods at night, and you come across this, this is what you'd see. But what it might really be would be an army soldier with a helmet on and a bunch of gear strapped to his body. And when I was in the service, we did this thing where if we're out at night ops, we'd put red lenses over our flashlights and hook a flashlight onto the strap that holds what we call 782 gear. It holds up your canteens and ammo pouches and all your gear. You have this like suspenders, and they have a place to hook a flashlight on there. So you can see, and so other people can see you, and it's, you know, it's safety and it's convenience, and but they're red. And if you look at a paratrooper, if you came around a corner and suddenly there's this person standing there, and it's a paratrooper with all his gear on and a helmet and two red flashlights, and behind him billowing out like wings are his parachute that he just landed on, or otherwise, the jetpacks are real. Okay. Just drop that. Jetpacks are totally real. They exist. They're a thing, and they're not new. They've been around since the 50s and 60s, and the U.S. military tested them, and they tried to get a jetpack that would work for a single infantryman to be able to fly in the enemy territory and land and fight. And they never considered it to be safe, at least what we're told. They never considered it to be safe enough. And so they discontinued it back around 1960. But that may or may not be completely true. But they definitely tested them. That's open source. That's out there. And there was a story in Soldier of Fortune magazine, which, you know, hey, it is what it is, but it does publish some true things that have happened. And in there, some former paratroopers said that they had been the cause of the Mothman phenomena, that they had been sent to West Virginia to test during Vietnam, to test a certain type of paint for painting targets. And they'd also done high altitude, low opening parachute maneuvers, practice. Okay. And that to me is an alternative explanation for the Mothman. That if you saw that, it would scare the hell out of me. I mean, you're just out doing your thing, and there's this person, it's like a person, but it's got this billowing wings. It has no apparent head, which if you're wearing a parachute and all your gear and a helmet, it definitely gives you an impression of not having a head when you have the two red flashlights at shoulder height, at, you know, on your body. If you just see that for a moment, it'd be really easy to see pretty much what's described as a Mothman. That would also explain the presence of foreign agents in the area. And I've speculated that some of the men in black weren't, you know, ultra-terrestrials or something. They were foreign intelligence agents who were looking into whatever the military was doing in the Point Pleasant area at that time, which may have been something. And Keel kind of hinted at this in the Mothman prophecy, so he didn't really follow up. He just said that there were military, there's a military scandal that would get everybody in trouble if they knew about it. But he just kind of, it's a one-off. He just mentions it and moves on to other stuff. And
I do remember him saying that in the book, yeah.
Yeah, and I really wish he would have elaborated on that, but that wasn't what he was looking for. That wasn't his focus. And I've just wondered if you came over from rural Russia or Bulgaria, maybe you would not eat Jell-O, you know? Maybe they sent you over here to find out what's going on because you're the guy that they've taught to speak English, but you don't speak it like an American would. And you know, Jell-O, I don't think they had Jell-O in the Soviet Union. You know, you're looking like, what the hell is this? You know, and you may have acted odd and looked odd, not supernaturally weird, but just off. Well, that's the way that a poorly trained, inexperienced spy would act, you know?
So the jetpack idea, I mean, it's interesting. There is, I mean, I was actually talking to a friend today about this and about how the Mothman actually paced the car that was going like 60 miles per hour. Do you think that the jetpacks could have gone that speed?
If I had to guess, and it is an educated guess, I would say yes, absolutely. I mean, they're rockets. I don't think they'd have any trouble pacing a car.
And they would have been able to control this stuff pretty effectively, and it not just be random.
That's where I'm speculating, yeah. But it's educated speculation that you would have to combine the jetpack for liftoff and, you know, propulsion with a glider type wings for control, and that would look just exactly like what the Mothman is described as. Wings that don't flap, and an ability to go straight up, an ability to fly along, and these big, not a bird wing, not an insect wing, but a sort of an artificial wing. And I don't know that technology exists. I don't know. I know things like that were definitely worked on. You know, many things are tested and then found not to work out. And do I think that's possible? Yeah, I absolutely think that's possible. And what were they doing there? Were they just testing, you know, I think it was like ultraviolet paint and high altitude, low opening parachutes. They could have been testing a lot of things. I mean, the secrecy, especially this is during the Vietnam War, and this is, you know, pre-Watergate. This is at a level where a lot of times the public just wasn't told anything. You know, this is before anybody knew about so much government malfeasance. That's something that was relatively harmless, because I don't honestly believe there was a direct connection. I don't believe there's any connection. Now, other people can show why there was. I'm not, you know, being too contentious. There could have been. But I don't really believe there was a connection between the Silver Bridge collapse and the appearance of the Mothman.
No, I don't think so either. And I think that that comes primarily from the movie.
Yes.
Kill never really made that connection. I think when the movie is written, which, you know, I mean, I've had Richard Haddam on the show a few times, and I mean, I don't think that, I think that that was just a device that was used for the film.
And even in Kiel's book, and that's not to cast aspersions, because, man, that's one of the best books of my life, but it wraps up the story.
Right, it does.
It because, can't just go on forever.
Yeah, essentially, I mean, essentially Kiel left after that.
Yeah.
I think he does make some kind of tangential connection that, like, this, look, this is a really weird year, and it culminates in this bridge collapsing. But he doesn't really say, oh, this is because of the Mothman, or, you know, I think that that's something that just got into the popular culture. I mean, he writes about, I mean, as you know, I mean, he writes about a lot of other weird stuff that's going on in I mean, Long Island. I mean, he writes about almost as much about Long Island in the book as he does about West Virginia.
His Mount Misery section is, to me, more interesting than some other stuff. But yeah. And exactly. The supposition that the military might have been doing some advanced testing there really rings true to me. And even the other phenomena that swirl around there, the people getting strange phone calls, they're all numbers. You guys have undoubtedly heard of the number stations, right?
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah. I've caught them live while listening to shortwave radio.
Do they still broadcast today?
There's still Cuban ones. The Cuban lady is still on there.
We got weird numbers station, like, interrupting our show now. I don't really know what's going on with that.
Wow. Okay. Yes. And they were, that was kind of like, you know, the heyday of number stations.
Yeah.
And that, to me, you know, could be the experience that causes somebody to think, hey, I've been, you know, hearing these weird numbers. This weird thing happens to me, without, you know, imputing any of the witnesses. You know, once you talk about something and you see it through a certain lens, everything kind of tends to build on what you already think. And, you know, the Mothman, like, kind of legend kind of grows from things that might have other explanations. And that's, right. You know, I just keep trying to keep an open mind with it. You know, it's an industry in that little town, and I would never knock that. I love the Hodag that lives in northern Wisconsin. But I don't think the Hodag was necessarily a real creature that was caught by the settlers. But do you guys ever hear of the Hodag?
I've never heard of the Hodag.
I think I probably have heard either. No, I've heard you talk about it. But I have. Maybe Josh Cutchin has mentioned it once or twice. Because I know Josh used to go to school up in Wisconsin.
It's in Rhinelander, far northern Wisconsin.
A lot of good Germans up there.
Oh, yes, yes.
Their whole dog.
I live nearby a town called New Berlin, so there's that, yeah.
Okay, yeah.
It's a suburb of Milwaukee, yes. But the settlers found a dinosaur about 100 years ago, and it produced quite the stir, you know, and they still have... The local sports team is named the Hodags, and they have, like, a little museum up there, and they do Hodag stuff. but everybody kind of admitted that, okay, the Hodag was a hoax. You know, it was done to generate interest in Rhinelander. So I'm not against that stuff. That's cool. But, and I'm not putting that in the same level as a Mothman. They're two totally different things. But I just think we should be open to all possibilities. And their misinterpretation and other things going on. And, you know, I just, like Kiel said, belief is the enemy. I don't want to be a diehard for anything. You know, that's not the Fortean spirit, you know?
Right.
So, yeah, I just saw some stuff there that it could very easily be a collection of different things that coalesced into the idea of it's this one thing. But yeah. Even in the book, I like the way Kiel talked about other stuff even better than the creature itself, you know?
Right. Yeah, it makes sense. That's interesting. I mean, it's an interesting idea for sure. And the time we got left here, let's talk a little bit about one of the true crime cases that you talk about. And that's the Lane Bryant massacre.
Oh, yes. And that's one that I have a definite opinion on. I have gone so far as to contact the police department in charge of investigating that, which still keeps it's an open case. It is one of the extremely rare unsolved mass shootings. Mass shootings tend to end with the shooter killed or captured or dead by his own hand on the scene. Also, it's one that happened in a woman's clothing store. For those not familiar, Lane Bryant is a chain of stores, still very much around, that cater to plus-size women. And this one in, correct me if I'm wrong, it's a suburb of Chicago, I believe called Burlington. But it's in Chicagoland. And a person came in and shot several people, all of whom died except a employee who was shot in the neck, who lay there and pretended to be dead until the shooter left. When I heard about this, I thought they're going to have this guy, which they were describing as a guy, a man. They're going to have this guy within days. You cannot get away with something that big. But it has never been solved, and there's never even been an arrest. There's never even been a named person of interest. There is nothing. Which, you know, I read up on it and did what research I could do. And I feel that they have been looking in the wrong direction literally from day one. I believe that a woman did the Lane Bryant massacre. I just find that way more believable than any scenario where this unknown man comes in. It doesn't seem to be a robbery, and it doesn't seem to be personally motivated in the sense that he was somebody's significant other or something like that. They searched the backgrounds of everybody who was shot and found nothing. And the picture that the composite drawing that was put together and that was recently, I say like last year, re-released, doesn't to me look like a man. It looks like a woman. You know, and I don't want to insult anybody, but not a woman I would find attractive, but guess what? You know, she's still a woman. Okay. And if you've never been looking for a woman, you've only been looking for guys, then you're not going to find the killer. And I absolutely believe that's one I do. I'd be stunned if this is ever solved and it's a guy. I just don't buy that.
You think they're going down the wrong path on this for a long time?
Yes, the entire time. They've only looked for a man. And they base that in part on there's an audio recording of the killer's voice. But what I heard there was a woman. Okay, a very angry woman, but a woman. There's also DNA from a coffee cup that has been like made into the holy grail of this case. That's male DNA. But to me, the fact that some man had a cup of coffee at some point doesn't really prove anything. I believe it was a woman. I believe that she was deeply upset with Lane Bryant. Somebody that worked there, maybe the place in general, maybe somebody insulted her. There could be a number of motives, but she shot that place up and has so far gotten away with it because they've never looked at her. And that would be my supposition.
Do you think that they just decided that this was a man because this is a typical male type of crime?
Yes, and absolutely.
This kind of idea that women would never actually ever shoot any place up.
Oh, yes.
Which, I mean, is something that I would think would be exceedingly rare, because every time you hear about this type of things, it is men that perpetrate these. But it doesn't necessarily have to be.
Exactly. It's overwhelmingly a male crime, but that doesn't mean there isn't that 1% that isn't, yeah, you know.
Right.
I don't know if this rings any bells, but have you ever heard of the song I Don't Like Mondays by the Boomtown Rats?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I know exactly where you're going here, but I'll let
you know. Yes. Back in the days before there were school shootings in the way we think of them.
Yeah.
I mean, I grew up in a world where that really didn't exist. A few years after I graduated high school, it was a huge deal. But I remember growing up and just that wasn't a thing.
Same here.
Yeah. Back in the 70s, there was a school shooting and it was by a girl. And it eventually was, you know, this band made a song about it called I Don't Like Mondays.
Yep.
After her explanation of the police asked, why did you do this? And I don't like Mondays.
That's what she said. This was in San Diego, I think in 1978 or 1979. She was like 14 or 15 years old.
Yeah.
And she grabbed her father's gun or rifle and just, she lived across the street from the school. And she shot into the crowd at the school and killed some children there.
Oh, yeah. It was a terrible crime. Yeah. It was just such a crazy one-off that, you know, there was no... You know, it wasn't a copycat crime, and yeah, it just kind of came out of nowhere. And I kind of think that, yeah, the Lane Bryant massacre was somewhat like that, that, you know, it's atypical, but that doesn't mean it doesn't exist.
There is an alternative theory in that case, though.
Oh, please.
That, some people think that she was covering for her father. I don't necessarily buy that, because I think she would have come out and said it by now.
That is now we're talking in the
San Diego 70s. Case.
Okay. Yeah, okay. Yes. Yeah.
That
is really bizarre. Wow. Yeah,
that he actually did it and she covered for him. But there's a whole documentary that's about this that I saw on Prime that they talked about. It's like an independently made documentary and they talked about her case.
That is fascinating. You wouldn't happen to know the title of it, would you?
No, but I'll look it up for you.
Okay, thanks. That is.
I think it actually might be just called I Don't Like Mondays.
Okay. It would seem so hard to pull that off, you know, to cover that up. I mean, people would seem to, but I don't know. I won't discount it until I've at least heard something about it, you know. Wow. That is really wild.
Yeah, it's definitely bizarre. In fact, whenever I was listening to your Lane Bryant episode, I actually thought about that too, because that's the only one that I can think of that was like actually perpetrated by a female.
There is one other that comes to mind, and that was, I believe, in the 80s when the phrase going postal became a thing.
Right.
Because there were several workplace shootings by postal workers. One was by a woman. I don't have a name on that, but it's really super rare, but it does happen. And
yes,
when it hangs there unsolved for this long, and nobody, there's a reward, there's, you know, the police haven't blown this off. That's the biggest crime that ever happened in that municipality. And they've really, you know, tried to solve it. But if you're only looking over here, you're not going to see what's over there, you know.
Looking in the wrong place, right.
Yes, yes, from day one.
The person that survived, they were the ones that did the composite sketch.
Yes.
And has anybody ever asked them whether they thought it was a male or female?
That I don't know. I truly do not know. I mentioned this idea on Reddit and, you know, I won't say I was driven off, but it wasn't as well received as I would have liked. There wasn't a lot of people weren't hearing that, you know, so I don't know whether that's ever been questioned.
Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, I don't know. It might be something that never really gets solved.
And that's very true too. Other than a deathbed confession,
yeah.
I just don't see that one getting solved anytime soon. Or perhaps somebody who's her longtime partner turns her in, maybe after she's died or something. I could see that as being a solution, but not much else. I don't see, you know, crack police work suddenly breaking this wide open. Not after this long. I just,
yeah, because it was 2008. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is a long time to have gotten away with something that serious. You know, I still, you know, it's a shocking crime, you know, and apparently in any sane way, motiveless, you know, there's not, you know, there's not some big till you're going to get at a clothing store in early in the morning. You know, that's just not going to happen like that.
Yeah. Well, Vincent, this has been very interesting. I'm glad to have had you on the show. We're going to continue on the Patreon side, though, and we're going to talk about the Nacita, Wisconsin Marian apparition and a couple other things. But tell people where they can find your podcast. The okay. Weird part.
Hey, first of all, hey, thanks for having me. I've had a great time here, guys.
Absolutely. Hey, thanks for coming on.
I can be found on Facebook. My podcast, The Weird Part with Vincent Treewell, can be found wherever you find podcasts. And I have a less organized than it should be, but still effective website at vincenttreewell.wordpress.com. That's probably the easiest ways. I am also on Patreon. I am not currently charging people, but that's probably going to change in a little while if I can get a little more productive here. Okay. But yes, that's where you can find me.
All right. Well, excellent. And guys, of course, you can find us, conspiranormal.com. And we have our Patreon, which Serfio can tell you how to find that.
You can find that at patreon.com/conspiranormal.
And we notice that we do have people dissing our Patreon. Still have not figured out why this is happening, but certain people have been just like interrupting our show and talking bad about us. And I've complained to our hosting platform, but so far nothing's been done. So I really don't know what's going on, but we're trying to get to the bottom of that. But if you want to join, we've got the $5, $10, and the $20 level. So, and don't listen to those guys that are trying to tell us that we're evil and all that stuff, right?
Right.
All right, guys. Thanks so much for joining us. Next week, we're going to be doing a Paranoid Styles. And I want to thank Vincent Treewell for being on the show tonight. And we'll see you next time on Conspiranormal.
Please consider becoming a Patreon at www.patreon.com/conspiranormal or leave a one-time donation at conspiranormal.com. And please check out our YouTube channel, Conspiranormal Podcast.